Jameson Lopp, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Great to be here, and specifically, always interested in having novel conversations rather than the usual, you know, repeating my various tropes on security, privacy, and why Bitcoin is amazing.
Yep. Again, those are great. Those are appreciated and necessary, especially with folks who aren't into the space and haven't had those conversations. I'm super grateful that there's people like you out there who are able to have those. But we're also glad to introduce a bit of novelty into your day. So again, this began, you had shared some tweets on Twitter about the intersection of God and faith in technology and in Bitcoin. And so then that spurred, you know, because of your following, like that spurred a whole bunch of responses that ranged somewhere between polite, respectful, and screeching, a whole range of other things. So I just kind of just replied, not knowing what to expect. And your exact response, if I remember correctly, was, "That sounds incredibly uncomfortable. And so I'd love to do it." And so just that attitude, I just appreciated that a lot. So I'm just going to let you kind of introduce yourself to people who may not know who you are. And then you can just kind of take it from there as far as why this conversation come to you as something that seems interesting and worth a discussion worth having.
I would say I like discussing controversial topics in general. And that may be one reason why I've managed to get a decent following on Twitter, is because I don't care if people disagree with me. I think the disagreement, at least civil disagreement and having, you know, rational discourse, is how we learn more about each other. And even if we don't agree with each other, we can at least try to better understand each other's perspectives. I think most people know me as a nerd. I'm a computer scientist. I have been engineering Bitcoin wallets for 9 years now. Been interested in the space for a little over a decade. And I just have a bunch of different nerdy projects where I have been trying to understand Bitcoin for a decade. And as a result, try to convey as much of my understanding to others, at least as simply as possible. And even though I'm a nerd and I mostly focus on technical aspects of it, I will say that over the past 5 or 6 years, some of the more interesting aspects have been less technical and been more, you know, philosophical, sociological, and trying to understand what is this thing that we call consensus. I mean, obviously, we know what machine consensus is, and we've automated a lot of rules around consensus for what we think sound money should be like. But there, I think, will always be this more ethereal meat space consensus that we're constantly trying to grasp at and trying to codify. And that's where, you know, a lot of the human aspects and ideologies come into play. Now, from my religious background, I'm a good old Southern boy. My father's side of the family can be traced back to the mid-1700s, coming in through New York, Pennsylvania, and then settling in North Carolina, I think by 1800. Pretty much all of my family is still in North Carolina, South Carolina area. And fairly conservative Christian background, went to 3 different denominations as I was growing up. Started off in the Baptist church for a few years, spent a decade in the Lutheran church, and then finished off my like middle school, high school in the Methodist church. And as a result of that, due to some of the interesting differences between these denominations, I actually went through the confirmation process not once, but twice, because the Lutherans, if I recall correctly, do it in the 5th grade, and then the Methodists do it in 7th and 8th grade, a 2-year process. Sure. Maybe even a 3-year process, but I think it was 2. It's been a while. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, I've read the Bible, went to Bible school, went to a Christian summer camp at least 3 or 4 years, even participated in running like vacation Bible school when I was in high school, and went to church every week, unless something crazy was happening, for my entire time that I was living with my parents until I went off to university. I will say I started changing my perspective probably around middle school, when we started getting more into hard science classes, learning about the scientific method, so on and so forth, trying to apply some of those concepts and square them with what I had been taught in the church. And then by the time I was going into high school and getting even nerdier and more into hard science, I basically threw up my hands and I was like, okay, you know, I get the narratives. It's interesting to me. I can't disprove any of it, but neither can I prove any of it. And so I've been a pretty ardent agnostic since then, and have tried to, you know, study some other religions as well, understand religion just from a high level perspective. And so I'm not an atheist. I don't hate religious people. I don't hate spiritual people. I think everyone should be free to do and say and believe whatever they want, as long as they don't try to impose those things upon me and affect my life. I certainly draw a distinction between spirituality and religion. My perspective is that spirituality is kind of man's search for meaning. And you know, there are so many unknowns out there, so many things that we are simply incapable of explaining, that it can be disconcerting, especially from a cosmic perspective. These things are very interesting but difficult to talk about. And in fact, I don't like to spend too much time thinking about them because they make me feel less of a person. You know, if you try to even comprehend that you are but a speck of sand on a dot in a void of a universe, it can make you feel basically worthless, right? It can make it very difficult for people to have a sense of value or purpose. And so I think spirituality is one of the ways that we try to reconcile this difficulty of handling all of these unexplained things. And so spirituality and wanting to believe in higher being or higher sense of purpose or whatever, I think makes complete sense to me. Taking it another step, though, and getting into organized religion gets a lot trickier. And I understand it from the sense of community, because I got a big sense of community for nearly two decades from being active within Christianity. Obviously, pros and cons to it. But you know, from a historical perspective, I also have a lot of problems with organized religion because it's run by men, and men are fallible and can do bad things. A lot of terrible atrocities have been committed in the name of religion. And in fact, in a sense, I see a lot of organized religion and churches as a soft form of a state. I think the simplest way to look at this is look at the Catholic Church. They are the largest landowner in the world. Mm-hmm. And how have they pulled that off? Well, there was, of course, some period of time when there was actual violence that was used, but it wasn't generally overt violence. Yeah. I see it as more of a soft form of coercion through threats, you know, the indulgences programs and all of that stuff. Yeah. You know, you're going to hell if you don't give us a lot of your property. And that worked very well for
them. Or your relatives are going to stay in hell if you don't give us money, or, you know.
And I certainly want to be careful, and you don't want to overgeneralize too much. It's not that like all churches are coercive and so on and so forth. But it's difficult for me to draw a line, I think, in many cases, between faith and indoctrination. And one of the things that concerns me and where I see a lot of parallels happening is between, well, the Bitcoin and the crypto space. I mean, each crypto network and protocol, its own opt-in network of rules, but also narratives. Yep. And a lot of people in the Bitcoin space have controversial views about what should be constituted as a scam and what's not a scam. And I'm sure we'll get into some of that and like why Bitcoin is the best in our opinions. But I see people that I consider scammers in the space using a lot of similar rhetoric and narratives as some organized religions, particularly when it comes to logic and making unfalsifiable claims. And so I've clashed with a number of scammers in the space because of their sort of cult-like antics. And now over the past couple of years, one of the things that has drawn more of my concern, and I think why I started bringing up some of these topics, is that I've seen more people start to tie their own religion and personal beliefs into Bitcoin. And so I certainly have concerns over what could happen if that trajectory continues to the extreme. In particular, you know, what happens if we end up with kind of sects or denominations of Bitcoiners who are so tied to their specific religion into Bitcoin that it could actually result in issues within Bitcoin and disagreements over the protocol and forking and so on and so forth.
Yeah. First of all, that was fantastic. We're going to get into a lot of the different specific things that you mentioned. I do think that comparing the monetary and religious worlds is a very fertile ground for comparison. There's a ton of things that these things share in common. And so I think that it can be confusing, especially to people who, I mean, I don't think this is a very controversial statement to say that we are the most secular society in world history. I don't think that's crazy to say that. I think
at least in America, I think that's true.
Yeah, but I would even say just beyond that. I mean, just even, I mean, if you were to poll people who would identify openly as an atheist or agnostic or who don't, they can't even make sense of the idea that you could believe in God. I think that there's far more people that are in that position today than they have been in the past. I think there's a number of reasons for that. This is another conversation, but I think fiat currency has played a big role in that. I mean, just the fact that if you can create money out of thin air, if governments and central banks can create money out of thin air to subsidize whatever ideas and messages that they want, and they don't want competition. You know, this is the origin of central banking, was trying to get rid of competition. It makes sense that you'd want to crowd out other messages that would challenge your claim to power. I think that we could probably make a pretty convincing case of that if we wanted to go that way. But let's just do this. Let's go this route. I screenshotted a few of your tweets and the ones that I thought we could kind of riff on a little bit, and that would be beneficial, helpful, and then entertaining at some level too.
Yeah. And I mean, like we said, these currencies and protocols and stuff have interesting narratives, but I think even beyond that, the internet itself is changing humanity. And I've actually been watching a number of interesting documentaries about different cults lately. And I think that a lot of these cults probably would not have existed if not for the internet, because the internet allows you to instantaneously reach out to billions of people. And now you're able to find the people, I think, who are able to be influenced by really weird extremist narratives a lot more easily than would have been possible pre-internet.
Agreed. And that actually leads right into the first tweet that I pulled out. You tweeted, "Social media sure puts the cult in culture." And so again, very witty turn of phrase. Great tweet. I guess you kind of just did unpack that a little bit, but is there anything else you want to kind of add in explaining kind of your think behind that tweet?
I wish that I was better or understood, you know, psychology better. Mm-hmm. But since I'm a tech guy and I'm a programmer, I tend to think of things in terms of kind of programmable state machines. And you can get into a whole argument about whether or not the brain should be considered as that. That's still, I think, an open question. Mm-hmm. But if we consider people's brains to be like computers, and these computers, they receive input. Currently, I've also said this, that our methods of communication are still incredibly primitive. Just the fact that we're using words is an incredibly low bandwidth and imprecise way of communicating our thoughts and what we're just trying to convey to each other. And yet, these words, these languages, they are still able to have an effect upon people. And I think if you hit upon the right narratives and that clicks with a person's particular background and basically everything that comprises them in their thought processes, then you can essentially start to reprogram their thinking. And that's what happens with a lot of these networks, you know, whether it's a religion or a cryptocurrency or a state, any sort of large group, usually that is being headed up by some sort of hierarchy or leadership. You know, the value of these networks grows as the size of them grows. And so any halfway decent leader of any kind of movement is going to be constantly searching for the right combination of words and narratives to reprogram as many minds as possible to join that movement.
Sure. I would agree with that. I would also say, and I think you'd agree, you can argue like the chicken or the egg problem. I would argue that, I mean, Bitcoin, the day that it was created, found, whatever, released, it was this profound thing. Even though it hadn't reached the wide adoption, the seed was sown, like the seed was sown that was going to turn into this incredible what it became. It obviously had to go through real processes, real dangers, real decision-making. I mean, the fact that in the beginning, there were a few dozen people who were into Bitcoin didn't mean that there wasn't some internal logical correlation between the way that Bitcoin was structured and the world in which Bitcoin lives and the world that we live in. Like there's correlation, real real, I would argue, like real correlation between those things. So like if Bitcoin doesn't prioritize Bitcoin mining and the structure mining the way that it does, it's not nearly as compelling, or if you want to use the word anti-fragile or something along those lines. So I do think that the rhetoric around these things matters. You can present these things in very creative ways and that helps. But I still think you can be the greatest rhetorician possible, and if there's not correlation between your message and reality, you're only going to be able to get so far over a given time horizon. You can fool people over the short run, but over the long run, it's a tougher road to hoe. The one thing that came to me as I was reading that was, again, just the etymology of the word culture. So the etymology of the word culture, it means like to cultivate or to grow. Yep. And so it's based in the root word culte or cultus. It's either, they can't decide whether it's, I think it's cultus is French or culte is Latin. And it means to worship or give homage to something. And so it's really interesting that right within this word culture, which is how things work and how things are priority structures and all these different things, you have this word worship right at the heart of that. And I think this is something in my experience, I would say one of the weaknesses in America and the West more broadly, especially the last 100 years, is we don't have a very good deep understanding of what worship or religion is. Like, we think about it in ways that they don't have the same depth as it has been understood and realized, I feel like, by a lot of people, at least according to different holy texts throughout human history. And one of these things, just within Christianity, you know, you have the Apostle Paul, he's writing to the Church of Corinth, and he says to them, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And so whereas we think about spirituality and religion, and we think it's, okay, I go to this service on this day, the Apostle Paul, and he's seemingly got a lot more in his head in terms of what is both required and what this consists of to have a relationship with God. There seems to be a lot more involved than the average, I would guess, American, and I would say average American would think. We just don't have the same type of religious culture that even exists in countries where Islam is the prominent religion. There's no separation in many of those countries between the Quran and law. And so I think that it's difficult is just, you know, just having a conception and a grounded conception of what religion is. I think it's hard to come to a point where people can agree on a definition because of our variety of different backgrounds.
It's probably related to the fact that the origins of America had a lot of religious persecution in the history. Yeah. And so I think as a result, Americans have built a culture, if you will, of not treading on people from a religious standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, again, where you are right now, it doesn't just happen, right? Like, the places where we find ourselves and what we find ourselves believing are either, I would say, directly related. We've received them from somewhere, or in many cases, we're reacting against things that we've received in ways that make a lot of sense. It makes sense that, you know, we have those kind of experiences. But I do think that's important. I think that really, when you're trying to answer this question of what religion is, you're really getting at the heart of what it means to be human. You're trying to ask, like, what is a human, you know? And without getting really in depth into that, it just makes me think of, there's a Christian author who wrote a book. He's a college professor. His name is James Smith. He wrote a book called You Are What You Worship. And he said, if you wanted to find the religious center of American society, he's like, you wouldn't go to a temple, you wouldn't go to something, you would go to the mall. He's like, what you find is you enter and immediately you're inundated with smells and with these pictures of people wearing certain clothes or wearing certain jewelry or looking a certain way, and they're happy. And you're walking in there, you're inundated with these visions of the quote unquote good life. And they're completely, the interesting thing he says is, they're not trying to reason with you. They're not trying to get you to think, do I have enough money for this? Or, you know, is this a good use of my time? They're trying to make you forget that. And they're trying to go right to, they're appealing right to your senses. And they're trying to go right at the, you know, as your sensuality. Like, they're trying to take that route to convincing you that you need their products. And so I think that this is part of the challenge throughout human history is, we have these senses, and the temptation is to be dominated and to allow ourselves to shape the way that we view the world around these sensual perceptions that we have. That's one temptation, and that can be helpful and good. But then we're constantly tempted to not use reason. We're tempted to only use our senses and rather and avoid reason or because reason is difficult. This is the reality. Reason is very difficult. And so I think that that's the combination or the relationship between faith and reason is something that you know brought out in a number of these other tweets that I found. I don't know if you want to add anything about that or just your thoughts on the relationship between senses and reason and I would say epistemology. I mean, how do we know what to trust between senses and reason? You know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big pieces of overlap is the challenge, the difficulty, you know, the amount of work involved to try to explain things using logic and facts. And this is one of the reasons why I started going down this path was to try to figure out, are Bitcoiners who are ardently religious being hypocritical with regard to some of the ethos of Bitcoin? Or what I'm really leaning more towards is that I think that in general, almost everyone is hypocritical with regard to some of the main ethos of Bitcoin of, you know, the tropes around don't trust, verify, and so on. And I've seen this play out over the years from several different perspectives over things that I promote, like privacy and security. These are other major ethos that a lot of people in the space talk about. And yet, at least from my own anecdotal experience and working in this particular space for 10 years of security, is that human nature is to seek and prioritize convenience over almost all else. And so the way that plays out with privacy is that very few people even think about privacy until it's too late and something terrible has happened. Similarly, very few people spend a lot of time thinking about their security until it's too late and something has happened to them. Religion, it could be interesting to try to get into understanding that more, but it does seem like a lot of people, they take the narratives that have been presented to them, you know, often through family. It's like it's a traditional thing. It's part of your upbringing. Sure. And I can say from my own experience, it's very difficult to reject the things that you have been taught for several decades, especially when there's the additional societal and peer pressure of understanding that you're essentially going to be ostracizing yourself from a decent portion of your friends and family.
I fully understand that in ways that, again, I'm not going to get into on the air, but I would love to chat with you off air because I completely agree. There comes points where certain beliefs that you have or certain conclusions that you arrive at that are maybe are out of step with the Overton window or out of step with some sort of the group of people that you've been formed by and grown up within. That reality of, if I say what I believe about this, I could lose, the cost could be huge. I think that's it's a challenging thing. Again, it's also necessary. You know, if what we're finding is true, then, you know, we should be willing to surrender the appearance of unity that isn't actually true unity. So I think this is a great thing to bring up.
You had a trigger word for me there, which is true.
Oh, okay.
I think that is one of the basis of all of the conflict around religious beliefs and so on and so forth, is what is truth. And especially, you know, it's been a while since I really dug into this stuff, but you know, over the past week or so, it reminds me of going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and trying to, quote unquote, understand Bitcoin. And my decade of going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole culminated in me writing a really long essay entitled Why Nobody Understands Bitcoin. And I think that is very similar to some of the issues here, which is that if you really want to perfectly verify some fundamental truth, you end up going down further and further down, whether it's like the historical rabbit hole or the scientific knowledge rabbit hole, and you can get to like the atomic level of things, and then you get to the like sub-microscopic level, and then, you know, most of the religious things turn into talking about creationism and the nature of reality itself, and eventually you hit the limits of human knowledge. It's like human knowledge, we simply do not understand everything, because to do so would require kind of omniscience and godlike understanding of the universe. And so at some point, as a human, you hit your own limits, you hit the limits of all human knowledge, and you have to decide, You know, this is the point at which I am satisfied that, you know, the set of assumptions I'm operating off of are good enough that I can call my conclusions to be truthful.
Yeah. And this is, again, I think you're rightly identifying part of the issue. Again, an epistemological one. How do we know? What are the standards of knowledge that we have? And I think this is where some of the disagreement, again, I understanding of it, but just the disagreement with some of the way that religious faith is presented at odds with science, I don't think it's helpful the way that it's framed. And this is mm-hmm. why. First of all, I think it's great that you acknowledge, like, everyone has a bent. Everyone has something that they're bent. First of all, shout out to Marty Bent. We have him as a bent too. But everyone has a bent, the thing that they're most familiar with. So scientists, they're going to tend to put more emphasis on scientific standards of evidence. People who, you know, I was a Bible philosophy major. And so that's just more my comfort zone than getting into an exhaustive conversation about Euclidean geometry or something. You know, some of these things that I'm not as strong in. But one of the things that it's easy to do is to minimize or just look down on the things that you're not as strong in and to elevate your particular area of expertise as if that is the more important or more real one. And so the reason why I think this is important is because the reality is that we have different standards of evidence within the world. We operate in these within several standards of evidence all the time. And it's not that you can exist without one or the other. We have to constantly operate within multiple worlds. And the two primary ones that I think will be helpful to talk about in this example would be the difference between historical evidential standards and scientific evidential standards. So scientific evidential standards are things that we can go out and are reproducible. You know, we can do experiments, we can repeat experiments and demonstrate repeatedly that certain things work a certain way within the world. Now, there's other things like historical standards. You know, we live in a country that has a constitution that was, I think most people would agree, there could be some radical skeptics who maybe know, but was, you know, was written by a certain group of men at a certain period of time who were influenced by certain things. And even though none of us can prove scientifically that these men existed or that, you know, we don't have blood samples from these guys necessarily. We can't compare them with active samples. You know, even though we can't prove scientifically, you know, these things that this narrative that we've been presented is true, we still go along with it. And we're okay saying that based on we have this book that, you know, these books or these things that were written in this time, there's things that are left over from these guys that they wrote, things that the ways that they reasoned, you know, we can look at them and have a reasonable degree of certainty that these things are true. The fact that we can't have scientific certainty is not somehow an indictment on historical lines of evidence. It's like comparing apples and oranges. I see this argument happen and I see people doing this. And again, I'm sympathetic to it, but I don't think it's helpful because it's trying to force an understanding of the world. It's trying to present the primacy of one standard of evidence that is part of the world we live in at the expense of minimizing another part of the real world that we live in as well. And so again, there's challenges to both these things. The challenge obviously with historical lines of evidence is people can lie. And so, and you know, people can be wrong. They can just be deceived and they can present things through their own lens. And that can be a challenge and that can cause problems. I fully recognize all those things.
I mean, there's provenance issues, right?
Yes.
The sort of chain of custody and retelling of things, or especially, I mean, if you want to get into biblical stuff, I guess you can question translations. And I guess the fact that most of these books, you know, they were probably written on parchment that didn't hold up very well and they had to get rewritten many times. And who knows what was put in or taken out or so on and so forth. I mean, one of the more interesting classes that I took when I was in university was a history class, and it actually ended up being more of a biblical history class, a completely secular history class, but focused a lot on Jesus. And my main takeaways from that class is that there's more than adequate provenance that there was a man named Jesus who existed in the time that we've been told, and that he went around and that, you know, he amassed a following. I think there was sufficient evidence that he was killed by the Romans. And then it gets kind of murkier because, you know, a lot of the things that were written about him were done decades, if not generations later. And then the books, the sort of looking at the way the Bible was constructed, is that happened over, I think, many centuries, and that there were plenty of biblical era texts and accounts that did not go into the Bible. And, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. we don't know anything really about the reasoning behind why some things were put in the Bible and others were left out.
Yeah, I would debate that a little bit. I mean, there definitely were things that were presented as being from a certain time period that, again, these weren't just guys who were just spitballing. You know, there were like one of the things I was just listening to Chris DiStefano. Are you familiar with him? He's a comedian.
Okay, no.
So he just went on Bill Maher's podcast not too long ago. And you have Chris DiStefano, who is, I mean, I don't know if he's Catholic. I believe he was raised Catholic, and he just said he didn't put much stock in it. But then he read this book called The Case for Christ. It's written by this guy who was a investigative journalist who became a Christian in his adulthood. And so he just read through this whole thing. And one of the arguments that Bill Maher presented against it was just the fact that as far as we understand, the gospel accounts are written, as far as we know, around 30 to 40 years after Jesus lived, or, you know, 40 or 50 years. And yeah. So that, understandably to a certain degree, like, raised questions for Bill Maher. He just said, I appreciate him on tons of things. He's been a voice of sanity on many fronts. But so, yeah, just this reality of the fact that these things weren't written for 40 years, that caused him great pause. It gave him great pause about trusting the, you know, the trustworthiness. Again, there's explanations for those things. You know, these guys are being literally chased, pursued, and, you know, all across the Roman Empire by the most powerful empire. You know, the fact that, you know, it took them a while to have time to, or they chose to take a while to sit down and write down their experiences. Again, I fully understand why that could be something that could be questionable. All I'm trying to suggest is that the fact that it took that long, there's no way these guys could have laid out the truth. You know, the fact that it took them this long, that doesn't follow. Especially, and this is, I would say, another thing that would help, especially given the consequences that these guys articulated from their own mouths for telling things that were knowingly telling lies. People object, understandably to a certain degree, they object to some of the gravity that is expressed to the consequences of things that are called sin. So lying, you know, there's a verse in the book of Revelation where it says, it gives this list of people who will end up in hell because of their sins, and lying is one of them. So if you are somebody who's one of the leaders of this burgeoning movement, and then you're saying this is the consequence for lying, and then you turn around and are lying, you know, you're going to be a hypocrite. Now, most people, obviously, in our experience, we've seen tons of religious figures be hypocrites, and there's plenty of non-religious figures who are hypocrites as well. And so, again, we're immediately skeptical of claims like this because of the how much easier it would be to believe that someone is just either hypocritical or wrong. Again, I think these are understandable objections, but I don't think none of these are silver bullets that somehow are somehow impossible for thoughtful people to believe.
Yeah, I mean, I think my short takeaway is that I'm skeptical of any and all things originating from humans. That doesn't mean that they're worthless. It just means that you need to, you know, keep in the back of your head that there may be imperfections, flaws, things left out. Who knows?
100%. I would say I agree. And that's where the Christians would come out, and the Christians would say, yes, if it was just left up to humans, then that is a perfectly, an even more reasonable thing to say. But the Christian claim is that God is superseding this process. Again, right. You don't have to believe that, but that's part of the claim, though, is that, like, God is superseding this process and helping ensure that what he wants to communicate is communicated. And so I think one of the challenges for especially people like us who have the ability, we have a technological ability for precision that in a certain expectation of different fields like science and history that are so much different than people were able to have 2000 years ago, that it's easy for us to dismiss different evidential standards. So for instance, it's easy for us to dismiss the way that things are done within the scriptures. So one example of this would be of the four gospel narratives, there's three of them where it presents the color of the garment that Jesus was wearing just prior to going to the cross. There's two of them that says the garment was purple, and there's one of them that says his garment was scarlet. Mm-hmm. And so modern people, we read that, and we immediately are like, that's complete, you know, look, this is, you know, prima facie evidence that this is, this just isn't true, this didn't happen, or that these guys are wrong. And so what we, again, this is just one example that we don't take into account is it's like many older texts, when they're telling things, they have more things that they're accomplishing than just giving the simple history. They're laying out, again, like multiple layers of things. So in the case of this example, within Jewish tradition, they would offer, one day a year, they would offer a sacrifice. They would sacrifice a goat for the sins of the people. And so there was one goat who would be slain, its throat would be cut, and they would offer it as a sacrifice. There was another goat that they would, the priest would put his hands on the animal. He would basically, pray this prayer that would ceremonially transfer the sins of the nation to this animal, and then they would let it go into the wilderness. And so in Jewish tradition, the color of they would tie a cord around this goat's neck when they let it out into the wilderness, and the color of the cord was scarlet. Uh-huh. And so the interesting thing about this is the context in which this color of the garment is given is in the context of releasing the criminal Barabbas, letting him go free, and then sending Jesus to the cross. And so there's biblical scholars who say, there's very good reasons based on the fact that that's the context that the author, I believe it's Matthew's goal in writing what he wrote about the color of the garment, he's not trying to make a historical point. He's using this thing to make a theological point about who Jesus was in his role. And so I think there's things like that within lots of ancient literature that present challenges for us when we want to take these things seriously. We want to give, special people, even people who aren't Christians or something, they still want to give these things a fair shake. And there's historical and just cultural things that provide challenges to being able to do that. So,
It sounds like you would agree with me that it's probably not a good idea to take the Bible literally.
I think I would want to define terms a little bit more than that, but I think I would agree with what I think you mean by that, which is things are not always as straightforward as they appear. We could go to a lot of different things, a lot of different examples of that. One of the things that I would love to kind of get into is, again, we've talked about this a little bit. You'd said religions are interesting in the sense that they are opt-in consensus networks. Some are more centralized than others. And adherents to any given religion tend to be maximalists who consider all other religions to be wrong. Then I'm just going to read a couple more of these, the responses to that, and then get to one of yours responses to that. Robert Breedlove replied and said, religion is also interesting in that it tends to lower the cost of establishing trust or maintaining cooperation among adherents to a particular religion in much the same way that money does for network participants. And then someone else replied to that and said, religions are also interesting to me because they work without any verification at all. They manage to achieve network effects strictly through the established trust Robert mentions rather than any sort of evidence. How can one be a religious Bitcoiner without mental gymnastics? To which you replied, what you mentioned earlier, this is an apparent hypocrisy from my perspective that I'm trying to understand. It's memetics all the way down. Perhaps we fool ourselves that Bitcoiners verify rather than trust. I think that totally makes sense. The one pushback, again, that I would give from the perspective of someone who does, self-identify as a religious Bitcoiner, would be, I think that don't trust verify is a very useful tool. I just don't think it's an absolute tool. It's a great hammer. And for hammering tasks, it's great. I just don't think that don't trust verify is this eternal maxim, this eternal tool that's good in every single context. And my basis for saying that is because all of us have human relationships to which we can't provide this level of scrutiny. The trust that we put in our loved ones can't stand up to this test of don't trust verify.
There's so many things that you can't verify. We can't verify what's going on in other people's heads.
Exactly.
And then, like, as I said, from a cosmological and even like understanding of the universe perspective, we simply don't have explanations once you get to a certain level. So at some point you have to decide that you're sufficiently satisfied with your what you believe your understanding is of a given situation.
Yeah. And what's your level of comfort in operating within trust within a given relationship, right? I think, again, marriage relationships some of the most intimate relationships that you have, relationship with your kids. Your kids, we are born completely dependent upon our parents, for better and for, in many cases, awful for worse. But I think this is something, this is the reality of being human in the world. Is humans are different than animals, in which many animals within a few hours of birth are able to run around on their own. They're able to secure food for themselves. Humans are not like that. And so I think that, again, I think that by virtue of seeing that, by virtue of our experience, we can acknowledge that trust is it's important, verification is important. We shouldn't just blindly trust. And I would argue that God does not ask us to blindly trust. This is not, there's a difference between faith and the idea of fideism. Have you heard that idea, fideism?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. So fideism is basically trust for trust's sake. It's basically, it'd basically be saying like, you can do it if you just believe, if you just believe hard enough, you can do whatever you set your mind to. Like that is very much at odds with the Christian understanding of faith, which we kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, where, it gets back to the relationship between reason and faith. One of the things that you see God in the scriptures say is he's, Israel, his people Israel are not going along with what he's asking them to do. And his words to them are not just trust me. His reasons that, or what he says to them is, come, let us reason together. He's actually asking them. He's like trying to encourage them to think about the course of action that they're making. And then in other places, God, or the Apostle Paul writes, and he compares people who are not, or people who are not living in accord with the way that God has designed the world, the way that he's revealed it to be. He says that they're living like unreasoning animals. And so Paul is saying, actually, the problem with some of these people is that they're just operating according to their desires, these physical desires that they have, rather than thinking. They don't want to do the hard work to think. They just want to, be free or to live. I don't think that at least Christianity, I can't speak authoritatively to these other things, but I think that the relationship, the hostility that some people perceive between the two, I think is overdone. I understand why that is, because, the belief in things like miracles, belief in, things like the resurrection from the dead, these are difficult to accept things for especially modern people to believe. But I don't think they're as hostile the Bible does not have the same level of issues that many people who are not religious attribute to the Bible.
So I don't know if you saw, but I actually ran some polls on both Noster and Twitter. And
oh, I did not.
I said, have you verified Bitcoin's supply schedule yourself, or are you just confident in it because you believe that enough other people have verified?
Yeah.
And, as expected, a higher percentage on Noster saying that they verify, it was like 60%. And then it flipped on Twitter. Only 40% said that they verified themselves. So 60% were trusting. But some other people had some good points that it still works out fairly well in terms of Bitcoin's security model, because you don't need to have everyone verify the rules of the network. You can, even if only one person is verifying and they see that something's going wrong, they can kind of raise the alarm.
Yeah, especially in a world where we have something like social media, where one person can access, can make their voice heard to a degree that, again, hundreds of years ago would have been impossible, right? Before the creation of something like the printing press, with the ascent of the printing press, you could make, your ideas and your thoughts, you could disseminate them much widely, more quickly than before that case. So I would agree. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, you had tweeted this and said, free your mind. And then you, as many people on the internet present a glorious meme from The Office. So the meme says, your religion does not prohibit me from anything. It prohibits you. Learn the difference. And so, again, this set off a firestorm in the comments below. So I'm going to read a couple of those. It says, Nitwit said, if everything is permissible, is that true freedom? Can we own, or can our own thoughts, actions, and choices actually unwittingly enslave us? I'm not being snarky. I'm just asking philosophical questions. You replied, ultimately, everything has constraints. We're all imprisoned in a variety of ways. Many are involuntary. Others are voluntary. So let's just get into that question. Again, this question of freedom and what is freedom? So we've already addressed the question of what is truth and kind of talked about how can we know? So now we're just, getting into this other small question of what is freedom? Could you kind of articulate, how did you understand freedom?
Yeah, I mean, I see it as agency. to be able to make your own decisions and act upon them. The opposite of freedom is having constraints that prevent you from doing specific things. And this is, of course, where it gets tricky again. And I think a lot of the controversy and contention around that is that most of what people think about in terms of religious constraints tends to be, I guess, around morals and ethics and like, what is good? How should you act as a human? This is a whole other rabbit hole that's interesting to get down. Obviously, some people believe that you can't really have morals and ethics without a higher being who you're essentially trying to satisfy their dictates or decrees, or you're trying to do and act the way that they want you to. I think this was one of the fundamental issues that I had that started causing me to distance myself from religion, which is that I was unable to square the idea that there was an all-powerful being that created me and therefore is also supposed to know all of past, present, future, and fully understand everything, and that they created me as a flawed individual that then if I use the brain that I've been bestowed with to question these things and to act in ways that I believe are moral despite what I'm told otherwise, that that dooms me to some sort of eternal punishment. It seems unfair, to say the least, and it's very hard for me to respect such an entity that would put me in a situation like that.
Sure. And that makes total sense. That actually brings us to, there's like a, you had a great back and forth with Jimmy, where I'll just get into the kind of what you mentioned. You said, I don't respond nicely to threats. This includes those who point a theological gun at my head and threaten me with eternal damnation. Jimmy replied, that's like saying Bitcoin is a monetary gun to your head, threatening you with eternal debasement. The choice to buy Bitcoin is yours. The choice to follow God is yours. The consequences are what they are. There are no threats. And then you responded, fiat is the threat of eternal debasement with literal guns behind it. Damnation is a narrative constructed by humans. It's noteworthy because only some organized religions decide to use the threat of damnation in order to exert control over the populace. The problem, like the inconsistency that I would see there is, again, just the begging the question of damnation is a narrative constructed by humans. So that would seem to be, standing on the same ground that it's trying to establish, right? Like that's the question, because the Christian claim is that no, God actually exists. This is, he's explained out this narrative of like, this is the world we live in where actions have consequences. And again, this is not some sort of accusation or some sort of like threatening of you. He's just stating very matter of factly, these are the consequences of choices. This is, this is just logic. If A, then B. I think that's kind of the way it's presented. I think, again, a specific example of this would be, God, in the biblical narrative, God tells humanity, he says, if you eat of the fruit of this tree, you will surely die. He just basically, he's not threatening them. This is not consequence. He's just saying, it's just like saying, this is a poison thing. If you eat it, you're going to die. He's not in any way threatening them. He's just telling them, hey, watch out. I just created you. You're in this place that you're just learning about. And then here is, and here's this mortal threat. Don't do this. Now that could bring us into a whole nother set of questions, which is kind of, I guess, more in the vein of what you described, which is, then why would God do that? And so that's a great question. But that's a whole different, level of things, because then you get into, here I am as a finite human being questioning the decision-making prowess of an all-powerful entity, who, made and designed everything. And so the fact that he would do something that me, the finite creature, wouldn't understand, that actually shouldn't, to me, that isn't surprising that there'd be some differences of opinion. But I don't know. Do you want to kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah. Idea? Well, so this is where, I like to draw the distinction between deism and theism, and why I think, as an agnostic, deism makes a lot more sense to me. And you may have also seen some of my touching on like simulation theory and stuff. I think someone asked a question about my views on God being an alien that's, you know, just playing with us. Amongst the infinite number of possible explanations and possibilities for a creator or a being, I think it makes more sense to me that a creator is running the universe as some sort of experiment because they want to see what would happen. It's much more difficult for me to, and so that would be the deism. It's like, okay, something created the universe, and you know, maybe they care about what happens, but either way, they're pretty hands off, and they're just letting it run. And then whatever happens, happens. And then of course the more theistic aspect would be, okay, the creator created the universe and they have a lot of reasons, and they're meddling with stuff, you know, they're creating their son, and they're sending prophets and manipulating us in different ways for whatever their end goal is that we don't fully understand. And it's a lot more difficult for me to square that as sort of an intervening God with the fact that God is also supposed to already be omniscient and understand everything that is going to happen. It's like, why even bother going through the motions if you already know everything that's going to happen, right?
Yeah, no, and again, that makes sense. And I think it makes sense on one level. And the reason I would say this, it definitely makes sense if you're an engineer. It definitely makes sense if you're a programmer, right? Because like there's a reason why this sentiment is pretty common within the technology industry. You know, this is not known for being a bastion of Christian belief. but I think part of this would be, again, you think about, man, this is a waste of resources, you know, to create this thing that, you know, has these flaws that ends up with all these, you know, all this waste from one perspective. At the same time, you know, just the reality of the pushback would be, the romantic side of things would be, you know, God could have created a world full of robots, but then that's not, you know, that's, then you know what you're getting, you know, with this way, like the, in the world, the way that, you know, God lays out, and the way that it's laid out in the scriptures is God is this God who creates humanity to be in one sense, his children. So he creates, you know, people who bear his image. He creates them to live and live like he does, basically live with the motivated by what he's motivated by and in doing the things that he does. So God creates and then creates humanity to kind of be sub creators, to go out into the world and take the raw materials of the world and make them, turn them into useful things. And so, you know, if God just, you know, makes everybody automatons and, you know, and then just boom, like there's no real drama there. There's no real, you know, mystery there, but the nature, and this really, what you're talking about gets at the heart of who God is. And you know, what is God's character like? What type of being is he? And so the ways that the scripture answers this question would be that God is love, and love does not coerce. You know, love tries to reason and tries to woo. You know, again, I don't know if you're in a relationship or not, but like, this is one of these things where, you know, we don't just walk around, you know, finding a woman and then grabbing her by the hair and you know, just pulling her along to go along with our desire for her to do what we want. Oh, I want to have this type of life. And so you're going to come along with me. Like the way that this works, generally speaking, is, you know, we reason with the girl or we reason. There's a reason process. We present ourselves as why we're a good match or why we're somebody that they should want to spend the rest of their life with. And so this reason process that is costly for us is actually, you know, it's a big part of what it is to be human. And so from that perspective, again, even though the cost, you know, God doesn't create, this is the other thing I would say, is God doesn't create the world flawed. God creates the world in such a way that he can be disobeyed. He can be not trusted. And then we'll get to experience, you know, the consequences of that. But he does not create a, you know, a world that's got these, you know, that like is this amazing place or that's this awful place. He creates a good place. And then again, gives humans the ability to do what they want within reason, while still reserving the right and the ability to step in and intercede. And this is what I would say is the reason why that's not, because again, you could say, well, there's been millions of people who've died, and so that's millions of people going to hell and all these kind of things. And so why doesn't God just intervene in all these, you know, in all these situations so that nobody has to go through that? Again, that's a great question, but now we're moving beyond what is, and we're trying to get at, well, why would he do that that way?
Sure.
And so that's just another you know, level of challenge. But I don't think God intervening, the fact that he intervenes, I just think about it like this. Like if you're walking down the street, and I see you don't see the car coming. I see the car coming towards you. I run into the road and I shove you out of the way. I have violated your will. I haven't asked your opinion. I just have interceded and I've pushed you out of the way of oncoming danger and I've rescued you. Now, again, have I violated your, yeah, I did. But again, it was because I assume that we're both under the same, you know, goals, to a certain degree of wanting to be alive. And so God interceding, he's preserving, he's like, I'm giving you free will. I'm giving you the ability to make choices. And yet, like, God reserves the right to step in and save us from the consequences of our own decisions. And so I think that's kind of the tension that, you know, we walk, it just in terms of the logic of it. I think I don't think it's illogical. I think there's definitely challenges, moral challenges that it raises, especially for us, but it's not illogical.
Well, there's, I guess the question of like God as a micromanager, you know, if you believe that God is omnipotent and omniscient and whatever, then there's no reason why a God could not intercede in absolutely everything.
Yeah.
There's so many explanations, I think, that make it possible to explain, how some of these things can be true. For example, and you know, I'm sure this will be blasphemous to many people, but this kind of goes along my whole simulation theory thing, is that whatever God is, from a relative standpoint, from our perspective, God is omniscient and omnipotent, and you could say, I guess, operating on what is it, like a different Kardashev scale, know, of amount of energy that they can manipulate. And so from a relative perspective, they very well may be all knowing and all seeing and be able to manipulate anything. But this is once again where we get beyond the scope of human comprehension. Just because from our perspective it's infinite, it doesn't mean that such a being would actually be unlimited. We don't know what constraints, if any, God may have. And it's not even really possible for us to fathom such a thing. Because once again, we're talking about what is outside of our universe that we can even perceive.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the challenge there would still be like, if God is an alien, then the question still becomes, well, where does the alien, where does the alien come from? You know, where is the, and I would say this would especially, like, that really, that all that does is push the question back farther into time. You know, that would be kind of my argument for it. And I think one of the best things, the most helpful things that I've read or listened to on this topic is a scientist named Dr. Stephen Meyer. He was like, went to Cambridge, got his doctoral postgrad in like evolutionary history, something along those lines. And so basically he comes out and the issue that we have is something like the ability of like Darwinian evolution. So there's lots of people who understand, who are not Christians, they recognize that there's the limits of Darwinian evolution, right? Like it can't demonstrate where the bang came from. It can only describe the post bang world. And so one of the things that he describes, and again, there's people more popular level, I would say, people who they wouldn't necessarily grant that. They think that, Darwinian evolution can, provide an explanation of the origin of life, period. But one of the things that Meyer pushes back on is he says, Darwin himself could be forgiven for believing that because Darwin didn't know about DNA. But one of the things that he points out is when the moment that we discovered that within every single cell of everything that's ever existed is a literal programmable set of instructions that you can, you know, adjust and produce predictable changes in. He's like that, the idea that we just, this thing just happened just kind of really just goes right out the window. And he says basically because in our experience, if we're going to use that as a standard is scientific, you know, what we can demonstrate, every single thing that we know about, you know, wherever we find coded information, it's the product of an intelligent mind. He points out, you know, when they found the Rosetta Stone, in the desert, they didn't go, oh, look, the product of wind and erosion. And, you know, even though nobody saw how this thing was made, nobody was there to observe it. We knew that it wasn't the product of wind and erosion. And it was because it was programmable information, repeated symbols, these same kind of things. And it was the product of an intelligent mind. And so this is the same similar kind of thing is, you know, the alien would still, I mean, I would imagine still be created out of some sort of organic material. He would still have,
These are all assumptions.
Yeah, I know, but there are limitations in order for life to exist. So, you know, you still would need some sort of nutrition. You still need some sort of, you know, something along these lines. If it's not an eternal, self-sustaining creature, if it's still a derivative creature, you still would need to come, it'd be derivative from something, be dependent on certain things. And so this is the claim is that God is this independent being. He's this creature that is this completely self-sustaining. He doesn't rely on anyone to exist. And so really the question that comes down to is the universe eternal or is God eternal? Somewhere along the lines, mm-hmm. we have, you know, at some point everyone acknowledges that there's this miraculous situation that is completely outside of our experience and our way of understanding how the world works. Is that the result of, you know, an eternal being who, you know, began this somewhere? He existed eternally, but then caused the material world and to exist. Or is this somehow other than that? Did this process just come about and we just have no access to it? To which many people would say, yet. And so right. Their faith would be in the, you know, there'd be, there's many people who operate by a basic faith that, well, just with given enough time, we'll find out more information and perhaps get closer to that. So I would argue we, both sides of the equation are still operating on a kind of faith. They're still operating on a trust that, either time or some other, you know, discovery will provide the information that we don't currently have.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit on why I think, I look at both atheists and theists from a similar perspective, is because there's ultimately unanswerable questions. And the thing that really irks me, though, is just how many assumptions people make. For example, first of all, we can't grasp the concept of infinity, and that's true whether we're talking about space, time, whatever. I mean, we don't even know that we understand time, right? So like, we don't even know that the Big Bang was the beginning of everything. We don't know that, you know, there could have been something before that, or maybe the before doesn't even make sense from our own limited perspective of what time is. It's mm-hmm. very mind-boggling. So it's I don't know. I think the most honest thing that we can do is to try to state what our assumptions are and then, you know, what we've built off of them.
I would agree. I think that, again, that's a good faith way of doing it. The one from a Christian perspective, the one thing that I would add is the Christian claim is not that, and again, this is going to be controversial for some people, but it shouldn't be. There's some people who are like, I've studied the scriptures, and so I believe. In my own experience, and in the experience of many other people, it's not that we did this exhaustive study and then we came, you know, to believe these things. It's like, in my case, I grew up in church, hated every minute of it, wanted to just live my life and do what I wanted to do. And even though I believe these things on a basic level, I believe Jesus was real. I just didn't want to have anything to do with him. I wanted to go chase girls and play basketball and, you know, do all these things. And, but there came a point where, again, the thing that I knew that was true, that I was just didn't want to have anything to do with, the thing that kind of broke through it, or the thing that changed, was just the, this guy preached the Bible. I heard the same story a million times. I could have communicated to you the same message that he told that day, but he shared it, and it was just basically like lights turn on. And it wasn't just, I believe that, again, mentally assent to these truths. It was, God loves me. And like, I know that God loves me in a way that materially changed how I saw and my desires to live in the world. And so the example is, when this happened, I was at a Christian camp as well. And the only reason I went there was to chase girls and play basketball. And the rest of the week, I was like, all I wanted to do was get alone by myself and read the Bible and pray, which I would have told you, you were a complete moron, preposterous that I would ever have voluntarily done such things. And so that just, again, I wasn't some saint who became perfect overnight. It wasn't that at all. But I just had a different set of desires that initiated at this particular point in time that have then continued on and you know, born different things. So that would be what I would say is it's not, the Christian claim is not fundamentally, like the Christian claim is that like God stepped in Jesus and he communicates his truth, the reality of who he is in a personal way through the preaching of his word. But there's still like, there's this, a testifying to the reality of what he's saying. So there's the communicated message, but then he is actually stepping in and interceding and kind of having the meet cute of these two things. So that would, I would say again, that the reason I mentioned that is because the Christian claim is not, we're all out here trying to figure out what's going on. And the Christians are, you know, they've got their Bible and they're studying and trying to make sense of it. And they're just doing the best they have. The Christian claim, which is, granted, it sounds insane, is that no, like God actually is confirmed these things. Like he himself has communicated, you know, these things. I grant all of the, well, what about the Muslims say the same thing? The Jews say the same thing. All these guys have their same thing. And again, I would say the same thing to that I would say to somebody who would say to me, well, Bitcoin only, but what about Ethereum? What about, you know, Doge? What about all these things? These guys all say that theirs are great too. You know, why should I believe yours? And then you go back to, you know, the key specific components of Bitcoin that would make it unique. I do the same thing. I go back to specific points within the Christian claim, the Christian gospel, that would differentiate themselves from other religious claims. So I'll give you another word on that.
Well, you know, trying to, I guess, tie it more into Bitcoin, do you, or have you come across more people who seem to be, you know, whether it's deifying Satoshi or using religious narratives like the Immaculate Conception of Bitcoin, yeah. or in general positioning Bitcoin as a sort of state of perfection that was bestowed upon us that we must not, it must remain, you know, sacrosanct. We must not, abuse it type of notion. Like, this is what I was getting at, is like one of my concerns of ways that this could have long-term negative consequences on the ecosystem if we start approaching Bitcoin from more of a religious view than a science and engineering view.
I would 100% agree with you. Both, again, you see the dangers. Actually, let me just ask you this. What are the dangers of that you see? And then I can kind of, I'll share kind of the couple that I see.
So this is one thing that I've talked about a bit more over the past year or so. I think there's some overlap with what you could call the ossification camp of, you know, the Bitcoin protocol is, some people might say perfect, others might say, you know, it's good enough and it has proven itself over the test of time, and therefore we must not touch it. because we're more likely to break it than to improve it. And of course, I, as an engineer, I see all, you know, software networks. These are living systems that are maintained by humans. And if you're not improving them, then they do tend to degrade.
Yeah, I would. So you see those things. And again, you see those things way better than I'm going to be able to see them or articulate them. The thing that I would see, and the problem with that I would see is more spiritual, which would be the temptation for humans all throughout history is to take a good gift and absolutize it and try to turn it into something that gives them ultimate meaning. Or they try to take this thing that's good and turn it into something that it was never meant to be. And so the thing that I would point out too is just money does not exist for its own sake. You know, money is a tool that exists to serve higher ends and bigger picture things. And so to look at something like Bitcoin and try to, you know, orient your life around it in such a way as, you know, and to like tie your identity to it and try and tie, you know, it, the preserving of it to, I don't know, like the reason why humanity exists or something along those lines, where it does get weird and cringe and all those things. I fully embrace and agree with you. It quickly, the religious discourse or the discourse within Bitcoin that tries to talk about it in religious terms can quickly get very cringe and go beyond what I think is either healthy, defensible, good, or reasonable.
Yeah, sort of a similar thing that I also see is, you know, the meme, Bitcoin fixes this.
Yes.
And, yep. And I think that is getting applied a bit more widely than probably it should be, is that I if people attach themselves to the notion that Bitcoin will fix many of humanity and society's problems, I think they're going to end up disillusioned and disappointed. Yeah. And you know, that could also lead to some negative outcomes. But it's like you say, you know, your money, it's a tool, and it can be used for good or bad. And I think it is very difficult to talk about, you know, how do we improve money, and with the understanding that improving money also means that it will be used for evil things.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah. And this is another thing that people, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I'm sure you've heard all these arguments of, you know, Bitcoin is used for drug dealing. It's like the dollar is used for 100 times more drug dealing than Bitcoin. Like, it just doesn't make any sense, this level of objection. Again, I'm like, let Russia use it all day long. Let Iraq, Iran, anybody like use it all day long. Like, this is, I mean, the reality is that good things are used for bad ends. You know, that's just what happened. But that's just what happens. But the benefit that it that Bitcoin has to the rest of us is a good enough and valuable enough thing to still, you know, desire for it to be around and still take action to incentivize its adoption, even though you're going to get this small percentage of people who are going to use it for, you know, truly awful child sex trafficking, all kinds of truly awful things. Yeah. You know, the benefits outweigh the cost.
I think there's a lot of, I'm sure there's many different sort of freedom arguments, but it definitely makes me think of Second Amendment, you know, firearms arguments. Yeah. As well. It's like, yep, the vast majority of firearms are not used for bad things and in fact are used for defensive purposes. But, you know, the natural consequence, and this is going back to the sort of freedom argument, but the natural consequence of giving people more freedom is that you're empowering more people, and some small percentage of them will abuse that power.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, this is, to kind of close that square, you know, just in terms of what freedom is, there's a pastor who is since passed. His name was Tim Keller. And one of the things he talked about, he basically says, freedom is more complicated than you think. He just basically said, so the idea of freedom not being simply the absence of restrictions, you know, like that you could have a fish who says, I'm going to free myself from the constraints of this ocean. And he jumps out of the ocean onto the shore and proceeds to die because he was actually, because of the nature of what a fish is, it's designed to find freedom within certain parameters. In his case, the parameters of seawater and, you know, these kind of things. And so I again, Tim Keller would argue, and many Christians, and I would argue that, you know, humans are the same thing. We don't find freedom within the complete absence of restrictions. You know, there are many different realms of restrictions which when we submit to, we find freedom. So you could, you know, nutrition, there's certain nutrients that our body needs where when we submit ourselves to that biological and physical reality, we find ourselves living healthier lives on the whole. There's, you know, a bunch of other things as well, relational ones along these things. And there's a number of different constraints that, you know, it's actually within the presence of the right restrictions that we find freedom. And again, that sounds weird, but I think it's pretty obviously true. Again, at the end of the day, though, there's, in terms of morally, you know, you could try to answer things like, well, you know, if you could try to get from is to ought. So, you know, there's certain, if we go around having sex with, you know, anything we want at any time, you know, we'll not only rampantly spread disease, we'll have, you know, kids all over the place, you know, all these things. You could try to go, okay, and because of that, because of these very naturally observable physical downsides, you shouldn't do this. But you really can't get there. You can say this is less than ideal, but you can't get to the point where where just on the basis of observation alone or scientific basis alone, you can say, and thereby you shouldn't do this, because we all have disagreements, or we all have risks, acceptable level of risks that we're willing to take in living life. And so if morality and moral principles are just these, you know, we're just these individual, each one of us is, you know, kind of operating, flying by the seat of our own experience and understanding, then that's just moral relativism at the end of the day. And that has all kinds of it's just fraught with danger as well, fraught with, you know, potential for things like you saw in, you know, Nazi Germany, things like you've seen in all kinds of situations, you know. And so this is where I do think it's important, you know, the idea of there being some sort of, most people, when push comes to shove, agree that there are things that are objectively wrong. The question is, the reality is that most people don't have a grounded, consistent basis by which to define what those things are. So you had mentioned earlier that people think that if you don't believe in God, then you can't be moral or something like that. In my experience, maybe there are people who believe that. In my experience, what I've heard people say was that there's not a consistent way to get morality without God. There's absolutely people who are way more moral. There's actually absolutely people who are agnostic atheists who are completely good people, you know, on many levels. But what I think the objection would be is there's not a logical, objective basis by which to define what is good and evil apart from the existence of some outside party, outside being, like, you know, in the case of Christian would be God. So again, I think that's kind of the issue is, you know, where do we find the basis, an objective basis for morality to be able to call things like child sex trafficking evil and not just less than ideal? Do you have an opinion on that? Like, what would be your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I had people ask me as well, like, what do I base my system of ethics upon? And like any good anarcho-capitalist, I base it upon the non-aggression principle. Now, I mean, I kind of see objective morality in the same vein as intrinsic value, which is that I'm not really sure that that's a thing. I generally see a lot of this stuff as being relative. Like even within religions, though, you know, you have many different religious systems. You could argue even then many people base their set of ethics upon different things. Like, you know, if you're one of the religions that believes in reincarnation, then there's your major impetus for being moral is not to go to heaven, but to, you know, ascend to a higher sort of level.
Not
of
end up a bug or something. Yeah,
exactly. And so I see the value in having systems of religious beliefs and supernatural deities that command a more objective way of looking at morals and ethics, because, kind of going back to what we're saying, people are lazy and don't really think for themselves. And so perhaps perhaps the macro outcome of having more people with a simpler, agreed upon set of beliefs results in a better world because of that. It's certainly possible. It could be an interesting debate in and of itself. Yeah. But this is, I think this is one of those things where ultimately, you know, a lot of the way the world operates, or at least individuals, it is anarchy, right? It is everybody deciding for themselves how they are going to operate and figuring out what are the actual constraints that I'm working under. Now, I have a general belief, I would have trouble coming up with, I guess, a proof of this, but I believe that human society and even Bitcoin only functions because the vast majority of people are what you might call moral or good or ethical, and that everything that we've built in human civilization, you know, whether it's our like religions and moral systems or our systems of government and law enforcement or whatever, that would all crumble in an instant if even like 10 or 20% of people were psychotic, sociopathic, amoral people. It seems like a lot of these systems that we have built are mainly to deal with these edge cases of people whose brains don't work the same way as the rest of ours, and you know, they just don't work in a way that is conducive to acting within a group that is healthy for the group.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think, again, the challenge is, because, again, it's real easy to define laws in terms of define them negatively. Like, don't do this or don't do this and don't do this. And so like the 10 commandments, when people largely think of, you know, of like what morality is, it's consistent of it's phrased in the negative. It's don't do this, don't do this. But I think this is where it gets really important is, you know, and this is where, again, as we're in this super secular moment and we're at this point of definitional crisis on a bunch of levels, you know, in terms of, you know, like what, basically, I mean, down to the very core of like, you know, what is a man and what is a woman? You know, these are like, I'm very sympathetic to, you know, we're at a moment where the question is, we found liars in every single part of life. You know, we have liars in offices of governmental offices and religious offices. We've seen all kinds of abuse. We see so much cause for distrust. So how do we know what is, you know, how do we know what things are? And so I think that this is, it's a very difficult situation we find ourselves in. It's a tough thing to figure out, again, by what standard are we making these things? Is it just positivism? Is it just, this seems right to me, and then we move on? That certainly isn't you could debate this, but like, I would say historically, there's clearly been, I mean, the American founders were very clearly looking at Roman democracy. They're clearly looking at, you know, the scriptures. I mean, you can go back and read, you know, they're appealing to Deuteronomy and, you know, the Ten Commandments in terms of shaping what morality was. They clearly, you know, even if all of them weren't Christians or theists in the individual, we all agree with a sense, they all recognized, you know, that they were very aware of the fact that you have to have some sort of basis for law that is outside of just our own desires or the positivistic move on the part of a politician or sovereign. And so they were, when they justified the rebellion against Great Britain by saying, you know, we are endowed by our creator with certain rights. And so, you know, they weren't just saying, we're just doing this because we want to. They're saying, you know, God has created people to do X and Y. Great Britain is not allowing us to do that. And so we have a basis by which to object to these things. And so I think that this is, again, the reality is that morality and these things, it does, at least on paper, it does stem from these deeper, more foundational questions of, you know, what are people? Who are we? How did we get here? Like, we have to have these questions to orient ourselves. And if we don't have some sort of existential anchoring for those things, then we're at the mercy of the strong man who comes along and wants to try to create or fabricate or present another version that's much more simplistic. And I would argue over the last 100 years has been much more damaging. You've seen tens, if not, you know, tens of millions of people killed by dictators who tried to set themselves up as the ultimate arbiters of truth. And that's kind of the situation that we're in, is just trying to figure out, how do we understand these things? How do we make decisions in a, again, I would just look at the United States, in a political climate where nobody trusts each other.
Short question is, why do you thank God for Bitcoin? And is it because Bitcoin is truth?
I would say, I thank God for Bitcoin. I love how you become the interviewer. This is fantastic. I would say I thank God for Bitcoin because I think Bitcoin is money the way that God intended it to work. It's money that doesn't let the powerful and rich leverage their power at the expense of, or gain strength at the expense of other people. It's one set of rules that applies to everybody. And so again, I'm not a socialist, I'm not a communist. I don't think that having, you know, ends-based equality is possible or would be good. But I think that, you know, one set of rules that applies to everyone, that everyone can plan and live according to, is something that, again, to our other point, is something that is freeing. And so I think that when humans have that kind of a standard, it's been good for people throughout history. And I think Bitcoin presents a much more equitable system than the current one that we have, that enables endless war and all kinds of other abuse and waste and theft. So I think that would be why I would appreciate Bitcoin. How about you? What would be your two sentence articulation or few sentence?
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason that why I originally got into Bitcoin was because I saw it as a way to leverage technology to empower individuals. So you could look at that as, you know, disempowering authorities that can continue to amass more and more power and change the rules however it suits them.
And I think that's a tremendously valuable and good reason to be involved in. So I'm glad to have you articulate that. In closing, I'll give you one more opportunity. You can kind of, you know, say whatever you want to say, where people can find you, or just if you want to, you know, end by making some other, you know, argument or just kind of laying out some other thing, go for it. This is your chance.
Yeah, no specific argument. You know, I think that part of the process of being involved in Bitcoin, you can be as involved as you want, right? This is an open collaborative project. This is also why I originally got interested in the space, was because I had never really thought about the function of money. Like most people, you just use what's presented to you. And when I saw, you know, both the computer science aspects and the philosophical aspect of treating this concept of money as an open collaborative project, I felt like that was the best way to get towards what you might call an equitable type of solution. Of course, it doesn't mean everybody is going to have the same amount of money and the same outcome, but hopefully it means that there will not be a small group of people who have the power to essentially outweigh, outvote, out, you know, manipulate everyone else to their own advantage. And while I don't know that this is necessarily going to fix many major aspects of society, at least anytime soon, I do think that it's at least moving in the right direction. Whereas, you know, as you've said, a lot of aspects of the world are moving in what we would probably consider to be the wrong direction, at least to the detriment of the masses. And if you're going to be participating in Bitcoin more than just, you know, from the financial or holding aspect, like if you want to help give your input to steer the system, and there's many ways to do that, then I think that this is the type of, you know, constructive dialogue that needs to happen essentially in perpetuity, is that the optimal form of money is still out there. I don't think Bitcoin is perfect. There's a lot of things that it can't do. It has constraints and limitations that many of us as engineers would like to see continue to improve. Better security, better privacy, better scalability. And we have to continue discussing with each other, what are the possible paths for us to go forward? You know, there's constraints from technical level, economic perspectives, and even, you know, philosophical perspectives. So the most important thing that we can do is to, you know, have these intellectually honest debates with each other and try to understand other people's perspectives.
Agreed. I'll just close. So in Proverbs 27:17, it says, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. And so I think this is one of these things where, you know, there's again, any of us who've spent any amount of time online, we get fatigued. You know in your head that it's good to have arguments, but there comes points where you're just exhausted. Like, you personally are just tired of having them. And it's just easy to just wish away and just like wish that you could have a world that wasn't difficult, that wasn't just such work to try to, you know, rub away at what is, you know, not real and temporal, so that what is good and more longer lasting or eternal, you know, can come through. But again, I just really thank you, Jameson, for your time and for this conversation. I hope this is beneficial to people, and hopefully this won't be the last conversation that we can have and here on the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast with you. So again, just give people where they can find you online, you know, give them your website and stuff like that, and then send it out on that.
Yeah, you can find really everything about me that I've done over the past decade at my website. It's lopp.net.
All right, guys, go check out Jameson's work. I know I've benefited from in the past from his articles. Again, he's one of the people who spent more time than anybody thinking about what Bitcoin is. And yeah, I'm grateful for his work in the space. So Jameson, again, we'll talk soon. For the rest of you, again, thank you guys for listening to our work here. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to either Spotify or Apple and leave us 5-star reviews. You can leave us truthful reviews if you think we don't deserve 5 stars, but those are the kind of reviews, just leaving reviews in those places help us to rise up in the algorithm and help us to be found by more people. So thank you guys soon, and we'll be back with another episode of Think Up for Bitcoin podcast here in the very near future.